Well, we've been in Genesis, the study of Genesis now for several weeks. And if you recall, having been with us any length of time, you'll know that we've broken Genesis into four events and four people: creation, fall, the flood, the tower. And now we're working with Abraham, the first of the four people that are mentioned prominently in Genesis. The last 2 weeks we were in chapter 18, and now we're in chapter 19. And the 19th chapter of Genesis is probably one of the most famous and most fascinating in the Word of God. And yet it's also a dark and grim and fateful story. The world has always had a morbid interest in the account of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Hollywood has seized upon this theme. It's made several films on it. I mean, why not? It has everything that they could be looking for. Many Christians are uncomfortable with the content. Indeed, the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19 is a shocking passage to read, and even tougher to teach and to apply. And to be honest, actually, I struggle even whether to discuss this chapter in the series or just jump right over it, especially since it isn't even about Abraham. But it is in Genesis, and it's fairly obvious in chapter 18, where the three angels, one of whom is the Lord himself, appear to Abram. It becomes pretty obvious that the functions of the angels in the story are not primarily to inform Sarah that she's going to have a child, but to destroy Sodom. But trying to study chapters 18 and 19 together would require us to gloss over way too much too quickly, the important instructions of each chapter. So depressing as it is, and filled with content best labeled for mature audiences, let's consider Lot and the destruction of Sodom today, because there are very important lessons here that we all need to learn from God. This chapter is very interesting. It's interesting from the standpoint of the sinful world. It's interesting from the standpoint of God answering the prayers of the righteous. It's interesting from the standpoint of God's people falling into spiritual decline and its devastating consequences when we do. But most interesting to me in all this is how in the world could Lot, a righteous man, we're introduced to him back in earlier parts of Genesis, end up in Sodom and have to be dragged out of the city by God? Choices have consequences. It's a very famous statement. It's a very true statement. It's important to recognize that Lot didn't get where he was overnight. He traveled down a gradual slope over a number of years, making a number of wrong choices and very costly, terrible decisions. How you and I choose in life determines the course of our life, determines the course of our character, of our legacy. As we consider Lot's decisions today, let us not remember that it's just a story from thousands of years ago. But I invite you to join me in asking ourselves, could we be guilty of making similar mistakes in our own lives? We open with Genesis chapter 19, verse 1. That evening, the two angels came to the entrance of the city of Sodom. Lot was sitting there, and when he saw them, he stood up to meet them. Then he welcomed them and bowed with his face to the ground. These are the same two angels who were with God in chapter 18. They had continued on their way down. While Abraham pled for the city, and they arrived at evening, seeing Lot at the entrance of the city of Sodom. Notice, in fact, that where they found him, at the entrance of the city of Sodom. This is more than just a place to meet and gather at the end or start of a day. This is a place meant for city officials and other men to discuss current events and transact business. It was a place of authority, a place where a person could see and be seen. Evidently, Lot held an important position in the government there at Sodom, or at least he associated with those who did. Things have changed quite a bit since we last saw Lot. Some 20 or 30 years ago have passed since Genesis 13. Genesis 13 said Lot chose for himself the whole Jordan Valley to the east of them. He went there with his flocks and servants and parted company with his uncle Abram. So Abram settled in the land of Canaan, and Lot moved his tents to a place near Sodom, settled among the cities of the plains. But the people of that area were extremely wicked and constantly sinned against the Lord. So he pitched his tent towards Sodom. He wasn't yet quite in the city, but he was near it. He was still in his tent, but he was near the city of Sodom, just outside the city of Sodom, in order to still take advantage of what the city might have to offer. Then in chapter 14, we read that he was actually dwelling in Sodom. By the time of the invasion of the five kings, He had moved right into the city. And now in chapter 19, we find that he's a man of great importance in town. Moses tells us here that when he first arrived in the city, it was extremely wicked. And he doesn't know it yet, but by the end of the night, he'll lose all that he's earned. And not too many nights from now, his home will be in a cave. Here was a man who was in a successful position in the city, the old familiar position of an immigrant boy from a foreign country who makes good in the big city. It's a rags to riches, poverty to power story. The local yokel makes good for himself in the big city town. But now I want to be fair with this man Lot. It's clear from the whole story of his life that he wanted to get something out of Sodom. That's true. But I think he also desired to give something back as well. I'd like to think that he thought to himself, well, maybe I can do some of these people some good. I'm able to win some of them from evil to faith. It's a wicked place, but perhaps I can improve its moral life. Now, this successful man, I'd like to this morning to ask him four important questions, questions that I think will reveal how much there is of Lot in Sodom and how much of Sodom there is still in Lot. And the rest of chapter should give us the answer to these questions. The first question I have is this: how has your choice of life in Sodom affected your own inner life? The second question: how much have you influenced the city for good, Lot? How effective has your life been in changing the city's evil? The third question: how much material advantage have you gained by living there? And the fourth and last question: what influence did the city's life have on your own family? Now, I think you'll agree these are fair questions to ask of a man who only wants to gain the best he can from the world while also living a life of fellowship with God. And the answers we'll find right here in this chapter. Notice that even though he was living in a wicked city, he still demonstrated the same kind of Middle Eastern hospitality that his uncle Abram had displayed. Verse 2, "My lords," he said, "come to my home to wash your feet and be my guests for the night. You may then get up early in the morning and be on your way again." "Oh, no," they replied, "we'll just spend the night out here in the city square." But Lot insisted. So at last they went home with him. Lot prepared a feast for them, complete with fresh bread made without yeast, and they ate. Now Lot surely knew what awaited the men if they stayed on the streets of Sodom overnight. And after Lot convinced the visitors to spend the night with him, though, trouble soon began. Verse 4, "But before they retired for the night, all the men of Sodom, young and old, came from all over the city and surrounded the house. They shouted to Lot, 'Where are the men who came to spend the night with you? Bring them out so that we may know them.'" And even though the narrative here uses some very polite words in order to discuss the situation in mixed company, knowing that there are young ones who are watching this as well, I think it's obvious what these men wanted. The names of Sodom and Gomorrah have always been associated ever since with this one thing. But the situation in Sodom and Gomorrah is so much more complicated than one single issue. Yes, it's about the corruption of the normal man and woman relationship, but it's also the outbreak of mob rule violence and people-to-people relationships. It's about the evil in a fallen man's heart towards God. And this condition of the city would face the judgment of God, and it should concern us as Americans too. Because really, is the moral condition of our own nation that far different from Sodom and Gomorrah? I have to agree with Billy Graham, who once said, "If God doesn't judge America, he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah." Pastor John MacArthur appeared on a Fox News program last month to discuss California's coronavirus restrictions on religious worship and what he referred to as the moral freefall engulfing the United States. Pastor MacArthur said, "We murder the babies in the womb. If they survive the womb, we try to confuse and seduce them into transgender sexual confusion when they're young. If they survive that, we corrupt them with a godless education," he continued. "If they survive that, we have divorce in the family. And if they grow to be adults, we drown them in a sea of pornography." MacArthur added, "This is a nation so far down in the sewer of immorality and wickedness that nothing surprises me." So far down in the sewer of immorality and wickedness. Well, this could certainly describe the situation we find Lot this morning, and Lot has to do something about it. Verse 6, "Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, 'No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing.'" Notice he calls them "my friends." At first, it looks like he's going to try and talk some sense to them. But then he does something even more astounding than what they've done. Genesis 19:8 says, "Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof." Can you really believe that? Do what you like with them. Lot sought to appease the men of Sodom so that the hospitality of his house would not be damaged. But in offering his daughters to this repulsive crowd, his behavior was just as disgusting, if not more so, than that of the people outside. But these men don't want the daughters. They want the men. Verse 9, "Get out of our way," they replied. "This fellow came here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge. Well, we'll treat you worse than them." And they kept bringing pressure on Lot and move forward to break down the door. Notice the extent of the evil of the city. This is the reason that God is visiting it in judgment. In verse 4, it says that all the men of the city, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. And as you read this account, you can see that Lot's reaction is disgust and shame. And this is no isolated instance either. This was just a common, ordinary event in the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. In the second letter of Peter in the New Testament, we see a little more of Lot's reaction to life in Sodom. 2 Peter 2, verse 7 to 8. "And if he rescued Lot, a righteous man, who was distressed by the depraved conduct of the lawless, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard." Well, our first question of Lot is, how has your choice of life in Sodom affected your own inner life? Is there rest and peace and quietness in your heart? No, that would be back there with Abraham in his tent under the great oak tree. But Lot is now here in the city of Sodom. His soul was continuously tormented by the wickedness that surrounded him in Sodom. What good is it to have luxuries and wealth and every material gain of power and authority and recognition if the heart is so continually filled with a great hunger that it cannot be fed or satisfied? How about question number two? Lot, what did you do for Sodom? How many did you turn from evil to faith? We continue on in Genesis 19. The two angels said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we're going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law, who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law just laughed, thinking he was joking. Even with his own sons-in-law, he had no influence whatsoever. When Abraham had pleaded with God for divine mercy on Sodom, remember, there needed to be found only 10 righteous men for the whole city to be spared. But when Lot went out to search, beginning with his own family, he could find none. His political power was apparently great, but his spiritual influence was absolutely nil. In fact, here's the record, verse 15. "With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, 'Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished.'" So our next question is, question three, Lot, how much did you make while you were in Sodom? What do you have to show for your years here? And again, here is that record, verse 15 and 16. "When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them to safety out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them." Here we see that Lot and his family had to be nearly dragged out of the city that was about to be destroyed. In verse 17, as we continue on in this story, "As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, 'Flee for your lives. Don't look back and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away.' But Lot said, 'No, my lords, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have already shown great kindness to me in sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me and I will die. Look, here's a town near enough to run to, and it's small. Let me flee to it. It's very small, isn't it? And then my life will be spared.' He said to him, 'Well, very well. I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it.' And that's why the town was called Zoar." Going on, verse 24. "By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land, and then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens." Thus he overthrew these cities and the entire plain, destroying all of those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now many have questioned how this event could have happened. What kind of destruction? What would make this kind of destruction in the valley? Now, some have called it a legend or a myth. It could never have happened. Others believe it to be the result of an erupting volcano. Still others believing lightning may have caused the many tar pits in the area to catch fire and to burn. And some point out, as I do today, that it says here, the Lord rained down the burning sulfur. Why do we as a people feel we have to find a natural explanation for a supernatural event? Bottom line for me, the Lord Jesus looked back over this incident, and in a solemn passage he wrote, "Remember Lot's wife." He goes on to say in verse 27, "Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land like smoke from a furnace." So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. If we want to know how much Lot finally gained in Sodom, we could take a trip today to the Holy Land, where we might stand on the shores of the Dead Sea, where tradition says that Sodom and Gomorrah are buried deep within that sea, and look out over that lifeless spot some 1,300 feet below sea level. If we're very still, we can listen to the lifeless waves tapping the beach. Nothing grows there today. Nothing lives. Nothing moves at all in that forsaken valley. How much did Lot gain? He lost it all. He was a good man who wanted to do right, but he chose his own way, and he lost his peace and lost his influence and lost all that he had. Still, he longs for a city, even a little one. The life of the city had so gripped hold of his heart that he had to live in a city, but even that was to be short-lived. Verse 30, Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he and his two daughters lived in a cave. And the last and most terrible question then is this: Lot, what about your family? We just read what happened to his wife. Her heart was too connected to the lust and pleasures of the city, and she looked back. Actually, I believe she probably did more than merely look back. I think she may even decided to return to the city that she had loved. Either way, she was caught by the flames and burned right where she stood. Her body was later encrusted with salt as the winds blew across her, and she became just a pillar of salt, as described here. Okay, well, what happened to your children, Lot? We just seen what happened to your wife, and now we have this account of how this filthy way of the city had become a part of his daughter's thinking too. Now the next part of the story is just as sordid as the one we've already heard. But one of the reasons I think the Bible is so authentic is it because it tells the good stories, but it also doesn't spare us the ugly side of the stories and of humanity, and we're certainly not spared that here. In fact, in order to keep that language a little more polite, I'm going to use the New King James Version this time as we go forward, 31 to 35. "Now the firstborn said to the younger, 'Our father is old, and there's no man on the earth to come into us, as is the custom of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we'll lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father.' So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. It happened on the next day that the firstborn said to the younger, 'Indeed, I lay with my father last night. Let us make him drink wine tonight also, and you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father.' Then they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose." You know, these two girls were virgin in body, but they were also corrupt in mind. They had long since grown accustomed to tasteless obscenities. So up in the cave on the mountainside, they seized on the thinnest of excuses to engage in an orgy of drunkenness and incest. What a depressing chapter, not only here in Genesis, but in all of history. Lot had nothing but heartbreak and grief to show for the years he had spent in Sodom, nothing but wasted years to look back on. The Lord has said, "For whoever desires to save his life will lose it." So Lot, trying to get the best out of both worlds, ends up losing it all. The last two verses of the chapter explain a little more why this awful story was even included. 37 and 38 says, "The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. He's the father of the Moabites of today. The younger daughter also had a son, and she named him Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites today." So here we discover the sordid origin of two groups, the Moabites and the Ammonites, who would remain a thorn in Israel's side for centuries. Now, I'm sure if we all are watching this right now, could get together in a group for a while and discuss this chapter, we'd probably find many lessons in this story. But for the sake of time, I'd like to just press on two right now to get them home to you. The first lesson I see is this, that the hour of danger is when you first begin to choose. We all experience it, but young people especially often feel the pull to be like the world, wanting to be popular, to have what everyone else has, to do what everyone else does. They want to be welcomed by their crowd, but be Christians too. They desire fellowship with Christ and a life of joy and power. So many try to do exactly what Lot tried to do, compromise so that they could have both. Some who come from Christian homes are drinking and gambling and stealing and lying about at home. They're playing with sex as far as they dare go and even further. At the same time, they also want to be in church to find the Lord, to have his blessings and his fellowship. The whole story, though, of life and scripture is that you cannot do both. You cannot serve two masters. No one can walk down two opposing roads at the same time. And if you're trying to live this way, surely you will lose it all, just as Lot did. It is quite possible to find your way, in fact, all the way at the top of the heap where you had worked so hard to get to, only to look back down on a burned out life, on empty, wasted, and barren years. Unless you change your mind and begin to actually choose to put God first before all else, you're going to continue in this very pattern that is traced out here today, until you wake up one day and find that all too is gone. Truly the hour of choosing and when you're setting the direction of life and not looking back on it. James Boyce says this, "You may think that you're different from Lot, but if you've put your job ahead of your family's spiritual life, if you've put your social advancement ahead of proper association with God's own people, if you let your choice of a home keep you from a church in which you can grow in faith and worship, then you have moved from the highlands to the plains of the Jordan." Pastor Bruce Gooch, after quoting these words, says he could add a couple more indicators to this list. If you're focusing your life on externals and not on your spiritual life, if you're focusing on attaining status rather than on cultivating character, if you're more concerned with what something costs monetarily instead of what it costs spiritually, if you're focusing on what will be the most enjoyable instead of what will be the most beneficial, then you are focusing on the wrong issues. Now, the second lesson I get from this is that when you attempt to gain the best of both worlds, you end up destroying others besides yourself as well. And right now, I'd like to take a second to speak right now to some of the parents who might be listening right now. What do you think was the greatest pain in Lot's heart? When he awoke from his drunken stupor there in the cave in the mountains and learned all that had happened? Do you think it was grief over his lost wealth, his vanished honor? Or could have been over the recognition of what he had done to his loved ones in Sodom, his little girl and his wife. You who are parents and listening need to remember you're being watched by your children. They see your desire to be right and to do good. But for some of you, they also see that the deepest thing in your life is to get gain or to enjoy pleasure. They see that you'll quickly sacrifice a night of prayer and family devotions in exchange for a night out on the town, that you're always willing to take a bigger salary, regardless of what it may do to the family in terms of new conditions or new circles of friends, that the things you sacrifice for, the things you're willing to skimp and save for, are not for God's missions or his church or the work of God, but a new car or a color TV set or nicer furniture. They are watching and they are seeing all of this. Surely this tragic story of Lot is taking place right here and now, in the modern Sodom and Gomorrah in which we live today. Remember, our lives don't have to end up like Lot's did. Up there on the hill and under the great oak tree is Abraham, whose whole life principle was to let God choose and to be satisfied with that choice. His first question always was never, how much will I make? But instead, will it destroy my home or my family? You know what I think is the saddest irony of all this? In the end, Abraham gained the whole land, even all that Lot possessed, and more besides. In Hebrews chapter 11, 9 to 10, we read this. And even when he had reached the land God promised him, he lived there by faith, for he was like a foreigner living in tents. And so did Isaac and Jacob, who inherited the same promise. Abraham was confidently looking forward to a city with eternal foundations, a city designed and built by God. Let us pray this morning.